From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Friday is the anniversary of the Oklahoma City bombing. On today's Fresh Air, tracking the militias and other extremist anti-government groups. We talk with Morris Dees, co-founder of the Southern Poverty Law Center, which has been monitoring the Patriot Movement. The center just issued a new report on the threat of anti-government extremists. Dees warns that the threat of domestic violence has increased sharply in the past year. Morris Dees, coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Frank Stacio. The United States and Japan moved to strengthen their military alliance today with a series of meetings. They reaffirmed their commitment to peace and stability in Japan and the Asia-Pacific region. NPR's Julie McCarthy reports from Tokyo.
The president described Prime Minister Rotaro Hashimoto as feisty, as unconventional, and said he liked him very much. The feeling appeared mutual. The straight-talking former trade minister, who had done battle so frequently with the equally straightforward trade minister Mickey Cantor, smiled and seemed to genuinely enjoy President Clinton. The two nations have worked out the sticky issue of returning U.S. bases on Okinawa to private landowners, a feat accomplished with the personal intervention of Hashimoto. The two men, who are on a first-name basis, took up a wide variety of issues in their 2 hours of talks, but it was the reaffirmation of the U.S.-Japan Security Alliance that will keep 47,000 troops on Japanese soil that dominated discussions. In Tokyo, this is Julie McCarthy.
There's more fighting today in southern Lebanon. Israeli military jets are bombing suspected Hezbollah guerrilla rocket-launching sites, while Hezbollah rebels continue firing rockets into Israel. This is the seventh straight day of fighting. More than 40 people have reportedly been killed, mainly Lebanese civilians. NPR's Suni Khalid is in the South Lebanon city of Tyre, where he says some of the 400,000 civilians who've evacuated have sought safety.
Most of the refugees in the Tyre area have gone north to Sidon and to Beirut. There are about 250 refugees that have trickled into the United Nations compound here. The United Nations is providing shelter and food for some of them. It's mostly women and young children. But the UN also has been sending out convoys to get people from villages which are cut off from the fighting. The Israelis have said that any civilian vehicular traffic on the roads south of Tyre and to the east of Tyre, that anyone traveling along those roads would be targeted.
NPR's Suni Khalid in Tyre. The U.S. and France have proposed peace plans to end the conflict. The fighting in Lebanon will not delay the resumption of Israeli-Palestinian peace talks. Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat and Israeli Prime Minister Shimon Peres have reaffirmed their plans to meet tomorrow. The peace talks were suspended 2 months ago after a series of suicide bombings by Muslim militants. A federal grand jury convenes today in Great Falls, Montana, and it could begin hearing evidence against Unabomber suspect Theodore Kaczynski. So far, Kaczynski's been charged only with possession of bomb-making materials. The Commerce Department today reported a big drop in housing starts. The government says new home construction took its biggest fall in a year, down 3.9%. On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 38.3 points at 5581.72. Volume is 203 million shares. You're listening to NPR News. Word that a rebel leader in Liberia may be considering leaving the country has raised hopes for a possible truce. Fighting among various factions in the country has led to turmoil in the capital, Monrovia. The most powerful warlord in Liberia says he will not agree to a truce unless the rebel leader surrenders. New Jersey is one of the first states in the country to file a lawsuit against a company seeking agreements with lottery winners to buy out their prizes. Gene Dillard reports the case involves a woman who was allegedly defrauded.
Assignment companies are springing up around the country with increasing frequency. They seek to persuade lottery winners that instead of taking their prizes in installments over 20 years, they should accept cash amounts up front and then assign the installments to their firms. In the New Jersey case, State Consumer Affairs Director Mark Herr says a woman sought to borrow $30,000 from Woodbridge Financial Corporation in return for assigning the company a portion of her prize. He says Woodbridge officials didn't tell her, though, they would charge her a 28% interest rate instead of the 12% they first disclosed.
It's this sort of unconscionability, this sort of deceptiveness, this sort of overreaching that the state will always oppose.
In an attempt to protect lottery winners from unscrupulous companies, New Jersey is considering following the lead of Texas and banning assignments altogether. For National Public Radio, I'm Gene Dillard in Trenton, New Jersey.
Russian parliamentarians today urged President Boris Yeltsin to lobby to make international sanctions to ease those sanctions against Libya. The request was sponsored by extreme nationalist Vladimir Zhirinovsky, who visits Libya frequently and views Muammar Gaddafi as a friend. The resolution said Russia had lost $30 billion through the sanctions. When Oprah speaks, the cattle markets listen. That's according to the National Cattle Ranchers Association. TV talk show Oprah Winfrey did a program yesterday on dangerous foods and cow disease, and cattle prices dropped. Cattle industry spokeswoman says ranchers are angry. I'm Frank Stacio, National Public Radio News in Washington.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. This Friday marks the first anniversary of the bombing of Oklahoma City's federal building, which killed nearly 170 people. My guest, Morris Dees, is the co-founder of the Southern Poverty Law Center, which monitors hate groups, the militia movement, and other anti-government extremists, and uses the courts to oppose these groups. Dees is the center's chief trial counsel. 6 months before the Oklahoma City bombing, Morris Dees wrote a letter to Attorney General Janet Reno warning that white supremacists had joined forces with militias, creating a recipe for disaster. In a recent letter to Reno, Dees warned that the threat of domestic terrorism has increased sharply in the past year. The center just issued a new report on the threat of anti-government extremists called False Patriots. Dees has a new book about militias called Gathering Storm. I asked Morris Dees if he's expecting any terrorist attacks this Friday.
You know, I would hope not. There have been some already this past week that the FBI and others are linking to these so-called super patriots, bombing of a bank and robbery of a bank and a newspaper in Spokane, Washington, and the bombing of a federal employee's car in California. I would think that, at least as far as federal buildings are concerned, the security will be so tight that it'll be difficult for someone to be as brazen as the bombers in Oklahoma City were and just be able to drive a truck up in front of it and blow it up. I don't think you'll see that happening. But there are other targets that these people aim for and talk about in all their material, such as railroad switching stations, railroad trestles, the actual assassination of federal employees, federal judges. So who knows what they might do? I have no intelligence or information that we've gathered to show that anybody's going to do anything on that given day.
Coinciding with the anniversary of Waco and the Oklahoma City bombing is the Montana Freeman story, where they're still refusing to surrender to the FBI that has surrounded their compound. Had you been monitoring the Montana Freeman before the situation started?
Yes, we had. In fact, I have some information and some background about the Freeman and about the kind of strange religious sect that they follow, the Christian Identity religious sect. These people have been portrayed in the press by some who are not really knowledgeable about them as being just, you know, disgruntled farmers who are just simply white-collar criminals who've written a few bad checks and et cetera. But they're much, much more than that. I was able to get a tape of a speech of some of the leaders at that compound about 2 weeks before the standoff. And the leader, who's now been arrested, stood up in front of the group and said, "It's a race war. It's a race war against God's chosen people, whites, and Satan's children, the Jews." And he talked about their common law court they'd held and the order they had issued in the court, and it essentially was that anybody who interfered with them would be killed. So they're a very dangerous group, and I'm not saying we should go in with guns blazing to get them out, but they're not some little isolated group like some of the media has pointed out.
What do you think of the manner in which the FBI has been handling the Montana Freemen?
I think it's been exemplary. I think the FBI obviously committed gross injustices out at Randy Weaver situation in Ruby Ridge. I'm not sure how the chips will come out ultimately on Waco. You can do a lot of money morning quarterback, and I don't think Koresh ever intended to come out. The FBI waited a long time, and I believe that maybe possibly he had something to do with burning that building like Jim Jones did in Guyana. But as far as the situation out there, I think the pressure is coming from the public and the news media to end the standoff. It's like we're such a television generation. We want our wars fought within a short time, like the Desert Storm War and the Falkland War were fought on television time almost. They were covered from, you know, battlefield to battlefield. And here, I hope the FBI doesn't allow that pressure to cause them to feel pressure. On the other hand, I don't think that these people should be allowed to thumb their nose at lawful authority, because they aren't just simple white-collar criminals. They've threatened the lives of federal judges. They're seriously armed people, and they're committing a kind of a paper terrorism, the writing of bad checks and the size they're doing against the federal government, and also in issuing these common law warrants and writs that they use to clog up the court system.
Your group, the Southern Poverty Law Center, has issued a new report called False Patriots about the threat of anti-government extremists. How do you think the militia movement has changed in the past year since the bombing of the federal building in Oklahoma City?
I think it's gotten more secretive. It's broken up into smaller, what they call secret cells, under a leaderless resistance concept that's been promoted by some of the leaders in this movement. The fence sitters who were horrified at Oklahoma City have shied away. The people that we saw on television, like John Trockman of the Militia of Montana and Olson and Southwell of the Michigan Militia, essentially today just generals of an army of one. They don't speak for, in fact, they're even laughed at by the real thinkers in this movement, the people that are actually promoting and encourage bombings and killings and domestic terrorism. I read an article in Time magazine that's out this week saying that the FBI has a task force set up that where they sit around once a week and talk about this issue, and that they've encouraged agents to go and, you know, have a beer with the John Trockmans. In fact, they mentioned him and they had his picture there. Well, he may talk to the FBI, but the people that are the dangerous ones, like those held up in the Freeman's compound, won't talk to the FBI. And I think that's the problem that we have in monitoring this movement. They don't like federal authority, and they've become more kind of underground.
Why have Trockman and other leaders who we got to know last year lost whatever credibility they had?
Well, I'm not sure they had any credibility last year. I think the media just ran out and found somebody that, you know, that with a coat and tie that could talk about the militia. And they tried to present a view that the militia was like a giant neighborhood watch. That kind of was belied by some of the militia publications that sold books.
When you say that, you mean Trockman and the other militia leaders who were interviewed?
Yes. Those people positioned themselves as being friends of law enforcement, as being individuals that were interested in helping old ladies cross the street, so to speak, and working with the National Guard. They're trying to put a face on the militias that I know the militias don't deserve, and that's not how they operate. But the real leaders in this movement quickly distance themselves from the Trockmans. I'm talking about people like Louis Beam, who wrote the book that is entitled Leaderless Resistance, and how these groups should break up into small secret cells, commit their acts of domestic terrorism when they feel like they're moved to do it. And if you catch that group, you don't break down the whole group.
Louis Beam, who you mentioned as being the founder, the creator of this strategy of leaderless resistance with secret cells, he's a former Klansman, former Grand Dragon of the Texas Knights of the Ku Klux Klan. He formed a paramilitary group called the Texas Emergency Reserve. You say he was later affiliated with the Aryan Nations. This idea of the leaderless resistance with secret cells, how can you tell that that idea is spreading?
All you have to do is really look at the militia-type or patriot-type crimes that have taken place, and they weren't the results of an organized group like the Militia of Montana committing a crime. If you assume that Mr. McVeigh and Mr. Nichols and Mr. Fortier and maybe others with them are guilty of the crime, that would be one of these so-called, like, spontaneous or secret cells. People who have a common belief that the government is evil, that they feel an obligation to protect our citizens from this government before our rights are taken away. They subscribe to all the publications. They read the books like the Turner Diaries, which is really a recipe or a blueprint for how to blow up federal buildings and cause a race war. All these things McVeigh did, and that's what Louis Beam says. He says, look, we don't need in this movement a general at the top. We need to keep our people educated as to who the enemy is and provide them with the materials that will motivate them and to move to action whenever they feel like doing it.
You describe the Patriot Movement as a potpourri of the American right, including Nazis, skinheads, Ku Klux Klan members, free men, militant opponents of abortion rights, followers of Christian identity. And you say it was after Ruby Ridge that they really unified around the hatred and paranoia against the government. How separate were these groups before that? Were they much less aligned than they are now?
Much less aligned. I think the thing that brought them together under the leadership of Louis Beam and Pete Peters, Reverend Pete Peters, who is a major identity minister in the country, was the incident at Ruby Ridge. In fact, a meeting of 160 of these people was held in Estes Park, Colorado, in 1992, 2 months after Ruby Ridge. And at that meeting, Louis Beam was the keynote speaker. And he said to that group in a very fiery speech that we are the enemy of the government. It doesn't matter whether you're a fundamentalist or sovereign or freeman or Second Amendment advocate, whatever you are, we are the enemy. And those men with black boots and helmets are going to come kick your door down. And they're not going to ask, what are you? Which group do you subscribe to? And then also we had the Brady Bill passed and the ban on assault weapons. And those two things fired up the militia movement and brought into it a broad base of people that would never have associated themselves with the Louis Beams of the world, the neo-Nazis, the William Pierce, the man who wrote the Turner Diaries, would never associate themselves. And so what happened was Beam and others in this movement who've been there for years changed their rhetoric. They stopped talking openly against Jews and blacks and start talking against the government. And the government became the whipping boy, the scapegoat.
Some people allege that there are similarities or connections between the far right of the Republican Party and the extremist anti-government groups that you monitored. Do you think that there are any such connections?
Well, I don't think that there are any connections between the Louis Beams of the world and the Christian identity and those who are in the far-right leadership of the Republican Party. I think there's an enormous connection, though, in ideology. When Pat Buchanan continues his campaign because he says it's for the very soul of the Republican Party, I think what he's really saying is what he believes is for the very soul of the American country or our government. And that translates to a lot of these militia people and maybe to Pat Buchanan as, whose America is it? When Pat Buchanan says we should build a wall in effect along the border to keep out these Hispanics and Mexicans coming across the border and immigrants, he's saying what you hear so many of these far-right people in the militia say, and that is that we don't want any more non-whites in this country. Maybe it translates to that in their mind. When Mr. Buchanan says that we don't want to send our jobs south of the border through various kinds of trade treaties, the militia people say the American dream has been destroyed because these non-white people in third world countries are taking jobs that Christian Aryan white people should have. When Pat Buchanan slams banks and big businesses, that plays right into the militia's belief that there's some Jewish Zionist conspiracy to control the banks and the monetary systems in the world. So they certainly get encouragement from the far right in the Republican Party.
Morris Dees is the co-founder of the Southern Poverty Law Center. His new book is called Gathering Storm, America's Militia Threat. Dees will be back with us in the second half of our show. This is Fresh Air. This week, many public radio stations around the country are fundraising. The future of each station and the future of the public radio network depends on your support. Your pledge keeps your station going and enables your station to be a strong link in the larger network. Please call with a pledge. Thank you. This week, some public radio stations are fundraising and are using this time for a pledge break. For those of you staying with us, we continue our special series from rock historian Ed Ward on the instruments of rock and roll. Today, the guitar. Ed considers how rock guitar came into being from its roots in the blues and country music.
The guitar is so central to rock and roll that it's impossible to imagine the music without it. It's not just the musical center, but the sociological one as well. It began in Egypt and northern Africa as the oud, and when the instrument came to Europe via Moorish Spain, the name was corrupted to lute. In the Baroque era, the modern shape of the six-string guitar evolved, but except for people like Schubert and Paganini, who used it as a portable compositional device, it wasn't taken too seriously anywhere but Spain. Its portability, though, kept it alive, and along with the mandolin, it became a popular instrument for American musical amateurs in the late 19th century. And, strung with steel instead of gut, it entered folk music. The blues, which developed around 1900, would have been impossible without the guitar. Played at dances, it was loud, and a good player could maintain melody and rhythm at the same time. And again, its portability suited the itinerant lifestyle of a blues musician. Interestingly, the guitar had gotten as far as Hawaii, where the technique of sliding a metal bar up and down the strings was invented in the early years of this century. A fad for Hawaiian music in the 1920s led to a new way to play. Not only did blues musicians take to slide guitar, but they influenced early country singers like Jimmy Rogers. The two parallel lines diverged, with blues musicians sticking with the original technique and country musicians developing the steel guitar. An improvement that both kinds of musicians appreciated was the amplifier. Playing electric guitar got you heard over the noise in a bar. Ernest Tubb scandalized country music with his electric guitar playing, but within a few years of his introducing it, it became standard. T-Bone Walker is credited with introducing the electric guitar to blues, and his virtuosity set a new standard that inspired many players in jazz and blues. The electric guitar is a different instrument than the acoustic guitar. For one thing, amplification makes it possible to sustain notes in a way you can't on the quieter model. As you can hear in this Muddy Waters performance, it also amplifies nuances you might not hear otherwise. B.B. King made a whole guitar style out of bending notes because he couldn't figure out how a slide worked, and the guitar's amplification was essential to that style. The other major guitarist of the early 50s was Merle Travis. His picking out the bass line with his thumb while finger-picking a melody on top enlivened hundreds of country records and influenced an entire generation, including Scotty Moore, who recorded with Elvis. Elvis's first record featured a pure Travis-style solo, and Travis's influence can also be heard in Carl Perkins' playing. Chuck Berry, a disciple of T-Bone Walker's, ushered in black rock and roll in 1955. His single-line technique popped up in the most unusual places.
If everybody had an ocean across the USA, then everybody'd be serving like California.
The electric guitar, except in the hands of people like Duane Eddy and Link Wray, faded out at the end of the 50s, and it was only the surf musicians and the highly influential Ventures, an instrumental combo, who kept it alive. It took Britain to wake us up again. Although the Beatles weren't virtuosos, the Rolling Stones at least pointed the way to our own great bluesmen. The 60s ushered in the era of the guitar hero, and that era remains with us. And although sampling and keyboards have risen in prominence in recent years, there's still something about a guitar that just says rock and roll.
Ed Ward is a writer now living in Berlin. Tomorrow his series continues with keyboards. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, monitoring extremist groups. We continue our conversation with Morris Dees of the Southern Poverty Law Center. The center tracks hate groups, militias, and other anti-government extremists. In return, extremists have issued death threats against Dees and burned down his office.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from the Crown Publishing Group, publisher of Father Goose, One Man, A Gaggle of Geese, and Their Real-Life Incredible Journey South by William Lishman. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with the second half of our interview with Morris Dees, co-founder of the Southern Poverty Law Center. The center monitors hate groups, militias, and other extremist anti-government groups that are part of the Patriot Movement. The center has issued a new report on anti-government extremists called False Patriots. And Morris Dees has written a new book about the militia movement called The Gathering Storm. Dees warns that the threat of domestic terrorism has increased sharply since the bombing of Oklahoma City's federal building 1 year ago. You know, the New York Times last Sunday had an article in which it said that efforts to fight domestic terrorism are being supplemented more than ever by private human rights groups that track the fringe right, groups like yours and the Simon Wiesenthal Center. And the article also mentioned that your group uses undercover operatives. What are some of your techniques for monitoring extremist groups?
Well, probably 99 or 95% of the information we get comes from public sources. We do monitor these groups. There are 75 or 80 web pages and internet postings. We get all the material that they publish and analyze it very carefully, recording the names and events of things that are going on. We clip some 13,000 newspapers and publications in this country to get information about them. We get sources from law enforcement. And at times, we use our own people to gather information that we feel that you can't get in these other sources. We never violate anybody's civil rights getting this information. We've been the victim of some violence from these groups, and we primarily do this because we're trying to protect our own selves and our property and our lives.
There have been retaliative acts against you and your group, bomb threats. You were, I think, challenged to a duel by Louis Beam, one of the leaders of the extremist movement. What's the worst thing that actually happened?
Well, I think the worst thing that happened was in 1983, late 83, three Klansmen broke in our building and burned it at Southern Poverty Law Center in Montgomery. With the help of the FBI and the ATF, we caught them, and one of them was on the board of directors of Louis Beam's Klan group at the time. Possibly this was done in retaliation for us stopping Beam's group down in Texas. We've had a number of rather serious death threats. When Alan Berg was killed, he's a Denver radio talk show host that was killed by one of these groups called The Order out in Denver in 1984. I was told by the FBI, fortunately in advance of that, that my name was at the top of that hit list. And from that date forward, and we've had some pretty serious security.
You suspected 1 year ago that there was going to be a serious anti-government event on April 19th, the anniversary of the end of the Waco siege. Where were you when you actually heard about the bombing of Oklahoma City's federal building?
It was a little more than a year ago I suspected a problem. I wrote the Attorney General 6 months before Oklahoma City, laying out the groups I thought should be watched and the reasons why. I was actually in Pensacola, Florida, taking the deposition of John Burt, who's head of Rescue America. I represent the doctor that was killed there. I just finished my depositions, and I was loading up my stuff early in the morning on the 19th to leave, listening to the squealing sounds of children playing in the swimming pool below, and one of my investigators said, "Turn the television on quickly." I turned it on in the hotel room at the Holiday Inn on the beach and looked at it. And, wow, I mean, you know, it's just you saw people running out with little kids. And I couldn't believe what I heard and what I was watching. It was a horrifying scene.
Outside of the horror of what had happened, what was your first thought politically about what had motivated it?
Well, instantly. I mean, within a matter of a minute, Joe Roy, our chief investigator, walked in and said, because I think the announcer said something about terrorists, Abbott looking for terrorists or something from overseas. And he said, they don't need to look overseas. All they need to do is look at some of these patriot groups in this country. I picked up the phone within 10 minutes and called a contact I have in the Justice Department and suggested that they look closer to home.
I'm wondering if before the bombing of the federal building, if you were often criticized for almost giving credibility to extremist groups by taking them so seriously and by thinking of them as a threat instead of a nuisance, you know, a few really extremist people who don't, in fact, have any power.
Well, Terry, we have had that criticism, especially when we started Klan Watch in 1980. You know, why talk about the Klan? They'll simply just go away, don't give them publicity. And it turned out shortly after that we had a lot of Klan crimes, a lynching by a Klan group, and it proved that what we was working on did have some merit. As far as this Patriot movement, we get some criticism from those on the right, especially religious fundamentalists, who say, look, you're lumping all these people together. You're saying the Patriot movement or the so-called Patriot movement in this country involves, you know, conservative Christian people, and that you shouldn't lump us together. And I agree that if that's what they interpret we're doing, we're not doing, because I think there are many good fundamentalist Christians in this country who are not for this. And also, a large number of people in the militia are good people. They simply are frustrated with government and join these groups for any number of reasons. What they don't realize is that the ones pulling the strings behind the scene here are people with a dangerous agenda.
Your group, the Southern Poverty Law Center, has issued a new report called False Patriots, The Threat of Anti-Government Extremists. One of the people you sent the report to is Attorney General Janet Reno. You have a lot of recommendations that you conclude your report with. What are some of the things you would like to see the government do to crack down on extremist groups, things that go beyond what the terrorism bill includes?
Well, I don't think there's anything in the terrorism bill really that make much difference with domestic terrorism, especially that thing that rushes along death penalty appeals. I mean, terrorists don't get on death row, and that's not going to deter them one way or the other. That's a political move. First of all, we want the Attorney General and the state's Attorney Generals, all 50, to set up a joint domestic terroristing task force to monitor domestic terrorism in this country. And that means gathering intelligence lawfully within the bounds of the Constitution. But when a group says, in effect, what they intend to do, that they intend to use violence to get across their views, then under the Attorney General's guidelines, those groups can be monitored without violating any rules. Also, information should be shared from the ground up. A lot of local law enforcement people are in a much better position to know what is happening in their communities, but they may not know what they're looking at. So we need to have some education as to what domestic terrorism is all about, the type of people involved, the kind of things they do. The public in this country needs to be educated and prepared concerning the question and the subject of domestic terrorism. Beyond what we asked the Attorney General to do last week, I would also like to see states enforce the anti-militia laws that they have on their books. 24 states have laws that strictly prohibit private armies. Second Amendment does not allow private armies. It allows a well-regulated militia, and that regulated militia has been held by the Supreme Court time again, to be the National Guard. States have these laws on the books. I've been a part of enforcing them in two states, Texas and North Carolina, and in Alabama, three states actually, and courts rule that those militia groups had to be disbanded in those particular states.
How many militias do you estimate exist now?
Well, we've added up all the numbers we have had, and we've seen there, and we come up with 411 militia groups in the country. Some of them may have disbanded since we started counting them a year ago, and there may have been new ones that popped up. They don't record their businesses like the Chamber of Commerce, so it's hard to keep up with them. I think that's a pretty reliable count. We count a militia group, and Michigan is a militia group, but it might have 50 smaller militia groups within it. So each one of those counts as a separate militia group. But what most people don't realize is that militia groups aren't just restricted to Montana and the Great Plains. They're in Florida, Texas, Alabama, North Carolina, and Connecticut, New York, and Oregon. They're all over the United States, especially those groups that don't necessarily call themselves militias, and the most dangerous ones don't. In Minnesota, you have the Minnesota Patriots Council, and that was a group that was caught last year with a plot to poison federal workers in a federal building through the water system. And in Virginia, a group calling itself the Hunt Club, Virginia Hunt Club, was caught with a plot to steal explosives from an armory. So most of these groups don't call themselves militias like you see on television. They have a lot of different names.
Morris Dees is my guest. He's the co-founder of the Southern Law Poverty Center, a group that, among other things, monitors extremist groups in America. And their group has just issued a new report called False Patriots, The Threat of Anti-Government Extremists. And Morris Dees also has a new book called Gathering Storm, America's Militia Threat. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Morris Dees, co-founder of the Southern Poverty Law Center, which monitors extremist groups in America. When the hate groups, the anti-Semitic and racist groups, came together with the militias, did you get more worried? Did that combination signify more trouble than you thought we were in before?
Yes, it did. In fact, that's when we set up our militia task force in the summer in August of 1994. And in October of 94, I was so alarmed by the mixture of these so-called militia groups with well-known neo-Nazis and racists. That's when I wrote Attorney General Reno a letter, sending her a list of the groups that we knew, the people involved in them, and the history of their criminal activity, and suggested that this combination of hate groups with those who have a background of violence is a real recipe for disaster. And I encouraged her to alert the federal agencies around the country.
What do you think encouraged the leaders of hate groups to link up with the leaders of militias?
Actually, I think that leaders of hate groups have always been stymied by the small number of people they could appeal to when they talked against the Jews and condemned blacks. In other words, when they were racist. A lot of people in this country just don't like to be associated with that. They had a hardcore group of people, but unlike in the civil rights days of the South when the Klan was large, those times have passed, and they were falling on hard times. But when they saw Randy Weaver, his wife and child, be killed, and when they saw the gun bills pass, the Brady bill, and then the handgun waiting bill, and then the terrorist bill, these people, like Louis Beam and William Pierce and Reverend Pete Peters, the Christian Identity, saw a great opportunity to expand their movement. And that's when they call all these people in.
I believe that Louis Beam, one of the people who you describe as a leader of the extremist movement in America, once challenged you to a duel. Would you tell us what happened?
Well, I had taken him to court and rather embarrassed him. He had the Texas Emergency Reserve. He just got back from Vietnam, been a helicopter gunner. And the Vietnamese fishermen in Galveston Bay were besieged by American fishermen who wanted him out. These Vietnamese fishermen worked hard, and they showed up the Americans, and so they called the Klan in, and the Klan, whether they burned the boats or not, some boats were burned. I went down to represent the Vietnamese fishermen, and in the process, got an injunction stopping the Klan from harassing these fishermen, and also joined with the Attorney General of Texas in enforcing Texas's anti-militia law, and a federal court enjoined Louis Beam from operating his Texas Emergency Reserve. He had big plans for having an army in Texas, and they trained with some active duty military, and they trained with uniforms and, you know, military-type weapons in five separate secret camps in the state that we learned about. Well, being embarrassed, Beam left the state and went to the Aryan Nations and became a kind of an ambassador at large up there with the Aryan Nations and going around preaching their philosophy. And he wrote me a letter when the postmark was on Aryan Nation stationery, challenging me to a duel to the death. You know, we both go into the woods and you know, you choose your weapon and the one that I guess is alive and standing comes out. Well, I wouldn't, you know, honor such a ridiculous thing. I decided that, you know, I'd fight my battles with him in court.
Oh, did he agree to keep it that way?
Well, you know, I hadn't been face to face with him since I took his deposition, and he looked at me and he said I was an Antichrist Jew, and that no Antichrist Jew could tell an Aryan soldier or Christian what to do in this country. Unfortunately for him, the judge was a black woman, and I think she gave the Klan their due justice in court that time.
I'm wondering how much direct one-on-one contact you've had with members of extremist groups, and if you've tried to have conversations with any of them, just kind of coolly describing what you think is wrong with their conspiracy theories and ideology and trying to logically explain why you don't think that really holds up under scrutiny.
I've had a lot of conversations with these people. I grew up with Klan people in the South when days in the 40s and the 50s when I grew up on a small cotton farm, and I think I know the thinking of these people. I don't think it'd do you much good to talk to Lewis Beam or Pete Peters. They are committed zealots. But in most of the cases that we've won at the Southern Poverty Law Center representing people against these groups, our star witnesses have been former members of their groups. In most cases, people that we convinced that they ought to testify for us. And we had nothing to hold over their head. It wasn't a criminal prosecution. These individuals like Beam and others have tremendous leadership ability. And I've tried to appeal to them that they ought to use this ability to get people to care about each other, to love each other, instead of hate each other. I think that it's hard to say what motivates these people. It varies. Some of the young skinheads today are motivated because of they've been losers in life. They have low self-esteem. They come from dysfunctional families. And leaders like Tom Metzger of the White Aryan Resistance, who appeals to skinheads, is looked upon in many ways as a father figure. One of his national vice presidents for organization, young Dave Mazzella, testified for us in a case on the witness stand that Metzger taught him to encourage violence and that he would do anything for Metzger, even kill for him, in order to keep his acceptance. This young Dave Mazzella did encourage three skinheads to do violence, and they killed a black man up in Portland, Oregon. I represent his family in a suit against Metzger.
Well, what are some of the current conspiracy theories that you find either most absurd or most alarming that are circulating?
Well, obviously, the most absurd are the ones that guys like Lewis Beam laugh at, because Beam, you know, doesn't have these big conspiracy theories. He and the Christian Identity people, like the Trockmans. Trockmans see black helicopters on the horizon, and they say that's, you know, that those are Russian helicopters. They say they're, you know, 100,000 Chinese troops stationed in salt mines in different parts of the country, and the government's building concentration camps. And they, like Timothy McVeigh, supposedly told people they plant microchips in your body so they can keep up with you. These are absurd conspiracy theories. And I don't think, though, quite frankly, that's what's motivating the true hardcore neo-Nazis and racists that are part of this patriot movement.
What is?
It's a belief, a strong belief, that the Aryan race is near the end of its line in the United States and in the world, and there's a giant Jewish conspiracy out to make sure that happens. They intend to do it through polluting the genes of the Aryan race through mixing with blacks, and they see the blacks as the Freeman said in that speech that was recorded about a week before the standoff, that the Jews brought the blacks in this country to use them to tear down the white race. Now, that may certainly be a conspiracy theory. I'm not saying it's not. But that's their bottom line, hardcore belief, and that's what this battle is all about.
Morris Dees, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Morris Dees is the co-founder of the Southern Poverty Law Center in Montgomery, Alabama. Its new report on anti-government extremists is called False Patriots. Dees' new book is called Gathering Storm, America's Militia Threat. This is Fresh Air. We live in a complicated world that requires us to make tough decisions every day. In-depth news and information is essential. You've come to rely on public radio, and right now we're relying on you. We need you to make a pledge. Let me be real specific about what your pledge means to Fresh Air. Each station that carries our show pays a carriage fee that goes toward our production budget. That's the way it works for most of the national programs. To continue broadcasting Fresh Air, your station needs to raise enough money from Fresh Air listeners to cover that carriage fee. Thank you so much for your support. Classical music critic Lord Schwartz says he's been waiting a long time for Virgil Thompson's Four Saints in Three Acts to be released on CD. RCA Victor has now reissued the historic 1947 recording, an abridged version, with Thompson conducting members of the original cast. Here's Lloyd's review.
Not April Fool's Day, a pleasure.
Saints
to lesser seated. Not April Fool's Day, a pleasure.
Saints to lesser seated.
My vote for the best American opera goes to Four Saints in Three Acts, a collaboration between two of the most original voices of the century, Virgil Thompson and Gertrude Stein. They both wanted to break the mold of traditional, sentimental operatic narrative. Like a Seinfeld episode, the opera is, as Stein herself wrote, about nothing. A saint, she says. A real saint never does anything. A martyr does something, but a really good saint does nothing. And so I wanted to have four saints who did nothing, and I wrote Four Saints in Three Acts, and they did nothing, and that was everything. The major characters in the opera are Saint Teresa and Saint Ignatius, though there are in fact both more than four saints and more than three acts. Whatever action there is was suggested by Thompson's friend Maurice Grosser after the score was finished. Here's one of my favorite parts, St. Ignatius's vision of the Holy Ghost, a passage that's infinitely more poignant because the words make far more than strictly logical sense.
Pigeons on the grass, alas.
Pigeons on the grass, alas.
Shot long the grass, shot longer, longer, shorter yellow grass. Pigeons large, pigeons on the shorter, longer yellow grass. Alas, pigeons on the grass.
If they were not pigeons, what were they?
If they were not pigeons on the grass, alas, what were they?
He had heard of a third, and he asked about it.
It was a magpie in the sky.
If a magpie in the sky, on the sky, can I cry? If the pigeon on the grass, alas, can alas, and to pass the pigeon on the grass, alas, and the magpie in the sky, on the sky, and to try, alas, on the grass, alas, the pigeon on the grass, the pigeon on the grass, and alas.
The opera broke a lot of new ground. The first performance, produced by a group that called itself the Friends and Enemies of Modern Music, took place at the Hartford Athenaeum in 1934, 7 years after Stein wrote the words and 6 years after Thompson composed the music. The production team was a who's who of modernism. The choreography was by Frederick Ashton, the staging by John Houseman. New York artist Florine Stettheimer created transparent scenery out of cellophane. Most daring of all for the time, the original cast, most of whom are on this recording, consisted entirely of black performers. They're all marvelous. Soprano Beatrice Robinson Wayne as St. Teresa and baritone Edward Matthews as St. Ignatius are especially eloquent. It's a heavenly work, in which the musical jokes perfectly match the verbal ones. Mock hymn tunes and Gregorian chants. Mock Baroque and Gilbert and Sullivan. Mock minstrel show and vaudeville all create an atmosphere of endearing but unsentimental sweetness.
Between 35 and 45, between 45 and 35, 45 and 35, between, they were 45 and 35, 45 and 35, when then they were 45, 35, 35, 35, 45 and 35, 35, 32, and to achieve the relief.
After the Hartford premiere, Four Saints ran on Broadway for 6 weeks, unprecedented for an opera. When George Gershwin saw it, he was so impressed with the conductor, Alexander Smallins, and the Eva Jesse Negro Choir that he hired them for Porgy and Bess. Thompson's notes to this 1947 recording refer to a completely happy collaboration. But in fact, he and Stein fell out and were not on speaking terms at the time of the premiere. Stein eventually saw the production in Chicago. Thompson himself conducts this 1947 recording in his own abridgment so it could fit on a single LP. To complete the CD, there's a wonderful 1946 performance of Thompson's suite from his score to Pear Lorentz's Dust Bowl documentary, The Plow That Broke the Plains. Leopold Stokowski conducts the Hollywood Bowl Symphony Orchestra. Thompson's sense of American heroism here includes Sunday school doxology and honky-tonk sleaze. Both scores are irresistible. I want everyone I love to have a copy of this disc.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed Virgil Thompson's Four Saints in Three Acts on RCA Victor. A new production by Robert Wilson will be at Lincoln Center this summer. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Technical direction from Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.